without bond at this point. So I think it's a very troubling development in this mere struggle against Fentanyl bombs. He's taken it very personally. So I'm moving the court to stop him from doing so.
Well, Benjamin Markison, the mayor of Orlando has labeled you and others food terrorists.
That's
Can you explain the mayor's logic as best as you understand it, and what precisely are you doing when you got arrested?
Well, I don't know what the mayor's logic is. All I can say is that we think that it's terrorism to arrest people for trying to share food with poor and hungry people in the community to meet a community need. And all we do is we come to the park and we share food with poor and hungry people. I don't know how that qualifies as terrorism.
When you were arrested, what were you doing, Benjamin?
Well, I wasn't actually in the park, and that day I hadn't actually ladled out any food. I was on a sidewalk adjacent to the park.
And what happened?
The police came up and arrested me and charged me under the City of Orlando's large group feedings ordinance, the one that requires a permit.
And the significance of Keith McHenry being arrested, Keith, who comes from the Bay Area, founded Food Not Bombs 30 years ago, came
right
down to Orlando. Is he still in jail?
Yes, he is. He may be there until July 5th when he has his first appearance on his food sharing arrest.
And how precisely what argument was used when this ordinance was passed?
Well, they were contending that the food sharings caused problems with cleanup. And I think they also were concerned. I think their basic logic was that the food sharings caused problems with cleanup and attract too many people to the park. But we share in the Lake Eola Park picnic area, which is the area that was designated for food sharing and food consumption. And when we first started sharing at Lake Eola Park, we were in a different part of the park, and we cooperated with the city and the police and the park rangers by moving to the picnic area. And less than a year later, they passed this ordinance to essentially shut down all food sharings at Lake Eola.
Now, a case that is getting a tremendous amount of attention is the case of Casey Anthony. Cheyenne Elahi, this is happening in the same courthouse, your filing of the lawsuit, and involves the same judge?
It is happening in the same courthouse, and it involves the same judge in the sense that he's the chief judge of the circuit, and he's the one who signed that administrative order that I'm moving the court to enforce. So basically, I don't know if the case will land in front of him. We hope that it does, but he is a crucial part of this. Amy, I would also point out that a lot of this battle that happened 6 years ago when Sordness was coming through was about gentrification of downtown. The downtown started to, the mayor started a development board for downtown Orlando, and his whole goal was basically to push everybody who was, the other, according to them, out, who was not, who didn't fit their idea of who should be in downtown. And we are trying to point out to the mayor that times have changed, that now everybody is hurting, and a lot more people, who come to Food Not Bombs food sharing are working poor. And this mayor just doesn't seem to understand that. By the way, I will add
Cheyenne Elahi, we're going to have to wrap there, but I want to thank you for being with us, attorney for Orlando's Food Not Bombs and Benjamin Markison, an activist with the group. That does it for our show. And I just want to let people know that Democracy Now! Has a new mobile website. If you have an Android, iPhone, or BlackBerry, open your browser and visit democracynow.org. You can read, watch, and listen to all of our latest news. Once you visited the site, today's stories will be available to you at offline reading, and we'd love to know what you think. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermaine Sheikh. Happy birthday to Karen Ranucci. Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, and Robbie Karen also produced today's show. I'm Amy Goodman Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 7:59. Stay tuned next for Talk Radio. Host Per Fagering will interview Lewis and Clark Professor Zahir Wahab and speak about Afghanistan, Obama's announcement about troops there, and the future of the country. Coming up next, right after these announcements.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Healing Arts Fair, June 26th from 11 to 3 at Euphoria Studios in Southeast Portland, offering holistic healers and intuitives as well as other resources to regenerate mind, body, and spirit. More information by phone at 503-575-0115 or online at portlandhealingartsfair.com. Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
This is Carlos Chavez. Join me on Political Perspectives Wednesday, June 29th, for a live interview with Paul Grusendorf, immigration law judge and author of My Trials, What I Learned in Immigration Court. This is the first book written by an insider of the immigration court system. Join us and call in with your questions. That's June 29th at 9 a.m. on KBOO.
Good morning. This is Per Fogring, and this is the Friday KBOO talk show, and our topic is Afghanistan, and I have two guests. Our guest is Professor Zahir Wahab, who goes back to Afghanistan regularly, just got back recently, and also on the line we have Gareth Porter, who's investigative historian and journalist, who recently wrote an article about President Obama's pulling out some troops, or saying he's going to pull out some troops. So anyway, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Perry, for having me.
And Gareth Porter, are you there? Oh, well, we're getting him on the line. Okay, well, we'll take this chance to say that, Zahir, you're going to be speaking, what, Wednesday, June 29th at the Unitarian Church. What's the...
That's right, with Matthew Ho, uh-huh. who was a military person, then State Department employee, worked in Afghanistan and then resigned in protest because he disagreed with the goals, objectives, strategies, and tactics of the U.S. Policy in Afghanistan and the U.S. Occupation. And so the two of us will be speaking, but we're also speaking in Eugene, too, next week.
Okay, this one here will be at the Unitarian Church, Wednesday, June 29th at 7 p.m. So now I think we have Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Oh,
yes.
Welcome to KBOO. And have you met Zahir Wahab, yes. Professor at Lewis and Clark?
I have not met, but I guess we're meeting right now.
Yeah. Good morning. It is a privilege to be with you, Gareth. I have enjoyed your pieces. I think yours is some of the most informed and informative commentary on the situation in Afghanistan.
Thank you so much. That's very kind of you.
Well, let's get to that recent article. You heard President Obama's speech, and you were... I guess, underwhelmed.
I was underwhelmed. I did not share the general enthusiasm of the news media for this. I remember the first thing I heard the next morning from NPR was that President Obama is now ready to end the war in Afghanistan. this was the perhaps the most fulsome description of what he said in his speech, and of course one that was quite undeserved. I think my general take here is that he was carefully, but I think quite clearly, telling the American people that he intends for the United States to maintain a military presence in Afghanistan indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he does so in more than one place in the speech. But I think the most important part of the speech in this regard is his invocation of the way in which the United States withdrew from Iraq. He refers to it specifically and says that that what we're going to do in Afghanistan is going to be, like Iraq, a responsible withdrawal. I think that should be taken seriously, and for obvious reasons, because there are other indications that the United States is very determined. The U.S. military and national security state are determined that they are going to maintain a semi-permanent military presence and access to military bases in Afghanistan, and they're negotiating with President Karzai right now.
Yes, as a matter of fact, there's a team from Washington trying to impose that treaty for a permanent U.S. base in Afghanistan.
Right, and I, you know, this is clearly going to happen, barring a very surprising turnabout by President Karzai. I understand from my own stringer in Afghanistan that Karzai's people are saying that he is ready to agree to this, that there's going to have to be a Loya Yurga, a major, you know, not self-selected, but selected by Karzai, group of leaders who will be convened in Kabul, who will approve the terms that he negotiates with the United States. And apparently that is, you know, those negotiations are already far advanced, and they're going to give the United States the authorization to station troops. We don't know how many at this point, but probably primarily special operations forces, but not necessarily limited to them. And they will get access to the major bases that the United States has built in Afghanistan well beyond 2014.
Well, if they do take out a total of 33,000 by next year, apparently that still leaves about 68,000 left, which
That's
is twice
right.
as twice.
He was very careful not to say anything at all about how many of those 68,000 troops will in fact be withdrawn and at what pace. And I think that was clearly a major concession to the military. In terms of his own political needs, I would say that he's going to need to reassure the American people that the U.S. troops are indeed going to be continually drawn down. They want to have a timetable. We now know that the latest Pew opinion survey shows that 58% of the American public wants American troops out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. Only 38% are saying that they want troops to stay there as long as it takes for the situation to be, quote, stabilized, unquote. I think American public now has spoken very clearly on the issue of the withdrawal of American troops. They want a timetable.
Well, it still leaves 100,000 contractors
and
50,000 NATO troops, too.
Well, the NATO troops are clearly going to be withdrawn.
Okay.
There's very little doubt about that. There are going to leave some trainers, but I don't think that there are going to be combat units of NATO countries left in the country, whereas the United States clearly intends to maintain actual combat units prepared to carry out war against the Taliban, as well as to potentially be used to go into Pakistan.
And really, there's some 100,000 contractors, which include people like Blackwater, DynCorp, Triple Canopy, people from Nepal, Argentina, and other places. And very few Americans know about this, what I call the shadow army.
Well, that's true. But I think we need to also point out that the vast majority of the private contractors, security contractors in Afghanistan are not, they are Afghans, in fact.
A third of them, yes, but yeah.
I thought it was much higher than that. I mean, the last study that I saw indicated that they were the vast majority of the contractors. But I mean, if you have something more recent about that, I will certainly recheck that fact.
Well, getting back to Iraq for a minute, Muqtada al-Sadr has said that if the U.S. troops aren't all gone, by the deadline, which is I guess the end of this year, that he will reactivate his Mehdi army, which really did a lot of damage to our troops there. So if we're going to be in a similar situation as in Iraq, in Afghanistan, what does that portend?
Well, first of all, I agree that Sadr does, in fact, still have a considerable voice in determining whether the United States is going to be able to station troops in Iraq past this year. And it's not at all clear that that is going to happen. I mean, we're still, I think, in a situation of great uncertainty about what Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is going to do about the issue of U.S. troops. My guess, if I had to say one way or another, I would guess that it's not going to happen, but I could be wrong about that. I think that the disadvantages politically to any prime minister of Iraq, particularly a Shia prime minister of Iraq, to issuing a formal invitation to U.S. troops is the negatives are just overwhelming. Against any positive advantages to Prime Minister al-Maliki. But, the parallel between the two situations, of course, does break down in the sense that, in Iraq, we have an agreement that the United States signed in November 2008 saying we would be completely out by the end of this year, whereas in Afghanistan, the agreement that we're negotiating is going to say exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge difference. I think the Americans, U.S. military now sees Afghanistan as its hope for a semi-permanent, meaning de facto decades-long presence in the Middle East or in the
Central Asia.
Middle East area. So.
Well, this is the Friday call-in show, and I have two guests, Professor Zahir Wahab and historian Gareth Porter. And if people want to call in with a question, the number is 503-231-8187. Gareth Porter, what do you think? Now, according to many people, there's a very interesting guy who writes for the Asia Times, M.K. Bhadra Kumar.
Yes.
And he has said that the Taliban won the war.
Well, I think they have won the war in the sense that they have established themselves as the primary political military force in the country, and that with the ultimate reality that the United States and NATO are going to draw down to a very small presence. I mean, that despite the fact that that the United States is seeking a permanent presence, it's not going to be anything like the 68,000 that are going to be left in 2000 at the end of 2012, or in September 2012. That means that if the Taliban merely continue to hold on, rather than to cease to exist as a major political military force, they will have won. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean that they will be a major force that cannot be excluded from the politics of Afghanistan. Now, how that works out in terms of power sharing, what it means in terms of the future of the Karzai regime or a successor, whether it means that there's going to be an all-out civil war between the Northern Alliance forces and the Taliban remains to be seen. I mean, I think that there's no automatic, you cannot automatically assume that the Taliban are going to take over the entire country, nor that they would necessarily plan to do so, and that that some kind of working, some sort of an arrangement between the Taliban and the existing regime, as well as perhaps with the Northern Alliance, is certainly a serious possibility, if not the most likely outcome of the present conflict.
There's talk about actually subdividing the country into north and south. I wonder what you think about that. The south being mainly Pashtuns and the north.
I certainly don't think there's going to be a formal division of the country. That would be out of the question, I think, from the point of view of either the
Afghans will not accept that, actually.
The Afghans will not accept it, right. Whether you're Pashtun or non-Pashtun.
Right, right.
But a peace agreement that that limits the fighting would certainly be, I think, not only possible, but certainly a necessity to allow the Afghan people to restore some kind of normalcy. And I think that there is widespread support for that among both Pashtuns and other ethnic groups in Afghanistan.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Thomas is on the line. Thomas, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. What a wonderful conversation. It's so nice to have two recognized experts on these important subjects. I could ask many questions, but I'll keep it brief to mostly one. You know, my question is this, is how much should we be deciphering the events, the U.S. military actions and occupations in areas like Afghanistan and Iraq, and indeed in the African continent, in terms of essentially something like a Cold War or not so Cold War, a proxy war with the upcoming economic superpowers of China and Pakistan? I mean, we know that there's extremely active jockeying going on to purchase farmlands, to purchase primary resources and materials.
Copper mines.
Indeed, I understand that just, among other things, that just within the last year there's been some news that's been released that initial geological investigations indicate that, indeed, Afghanistan may be the world's largest repository of lithium, which is an absolutely crucial element in high technology. And so my question is if can we consider this more, instead of thinking about terms of the cover stories of democracy or even in terms of, let's say, the corporate cash cow of military contractors and how that plays in, can we think that maybe perhaps that we're seeing a larger geopolitical economic proxy war with countries such as India and China taking mm-hmm. place?
Well, I mean, I have a very simple answer and a more complicated answer to that. The simple answer is no. I do not at all buy the notion that the U.S. military is engaged in these wars and in the pursuit of military bases, semi-permanent military bases, in order to pursue a war for oil or for other minerals. This is an idea that is understandable, but it reflects the mentality or the assumptions that went with the colonial wars of the 19th century. By the mid-20th century, after World War II, we had a completely different structure in the world economy and politics, in which really, except for a period of perhaps early Cold War, there was no country, there was no state or even non-state actors who were in any sense trying to block the free trade of goods and services between one country, an underdeveloped country, if you will, a developing country on one hand, and a superpower on the other. The fact is, the United States doesn't need military forces in Afghanistan or in Iraq to be able to buy resources, just as the Chinese don't need military forces there to buy resources or to invest in the development of those resources. Those are two entirely different logics, and I would suggest to the caller that it's very important to understand that the interests of the U.S. military are very self-oriented. They're self-contained. The military services and the Pentagon have a set of bureaucratic political interests which justify the use of force and the maintaining of U.S. forces, deployment of forces in bases abroad for their own sake. not because they care about the resources of the region. Even though I agree that the military will not fail to take advantage of any rationale that they can, and you will hear, you know, the military on many occasions suggest that they're really needed there to protect U.S. access to oil resources or to other resources. I don't believe it for a moment, is all I can say.
But the military takes its orders from somebody.
Well, and isn't it also possible to think, I mean, why does it have to be one actor? I mean, clearly the military-industrial complex has its own desires and its own need, and there's a history and massive documentation of this, and they're a key player of almost war for war's sake. But, you know, are we really, you know, isn't there a huge, another elephant in the room? I mean, clearly, I mean, State Department documents, leaks, and we know this. We go back to Chile and the copper mines. We go back to Bolivia and the tin mines. We talk about the tungsten resources in Southeast Asia. I mean, isn't it really incredibly almost putting things on a Procrustean bed to put too much weight on the military component and to deny that there is this other component? I seems like we'd be in error of creating perhaps a falsity on the other side by doing so.
I don't disagree at all that the CIA intervention in Chile was on behalf of U.S. corporate interests, and that the U.S. Intervened in Latin America during the early 20th century on behalf of corporate interests. But when you're talking about major wars such as Iraq and Afghanistan, you are now really transcending those sort of traditional corporate interest models of U.S. policies, and then you get a set of interests which are so much more enormous in regard to the amount of money and power that is involved that you cannot compare them with what might have happened in Central America or in Chile in terms of U.S. diplomacy and covert operations. We're talking about trillions of dollars at stake in the military budget. We're talking about power in the military services such as no human organization has ever known. And I would suggest that is so much bigger than any possible corporate interest in developing resources might be, that there's simply no comparison.
My take on that is slightly different. I think you're right, Mr. Porter, but I really also think that the issue of oil and gas, the Central Asian Caspian oil and gas is a major factor, but also I think the U.S. trying to sort of push back the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the U.S. sort of indirectly in competition with India, China, and Russia, but also the U.S. trying to isolate Iran. So I would say that in addition to the military establishment itself becoming a major factor, there are these other factors, plus the ideological and religious factors, too. Would you not agree? I mean, they all sort of intersect, the ideological, economic, political, and religious factors. No?
Well, I think that there is an intersection of a lot of different factors, but the ideology at this point, I mean, what are we talking about in terms of ideology? I'm not sure exactly what that would be.
Well, the worldview. Robert Gates saying the other day to the press that all his life he has lived in a country that was a superpower in the world, and something to that effect, and that he can't imagine living otherwise.
Yeah, see, so that's not ideology. That's the enjoyment by the national security elite of the perquisites of power that go with the United States engagement, as he calls it, in the world. Mm. I mean, I think that quote actually reinforces my point that the real interests that we have to come to grips with in this country are interests that have to do with the power of the institutions of the military and the Pentagon and the CIA, the CIA's
and the intelligence community and the terrorism industry now, yeah.
The terrorism industry and indeed the conventional conventional war industry as well. These are the most powerful forces in this country politically, as well as in terms of their control over financial resources, budgetary resources.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you about the You know, when the Afghanistan war sort of really began, that people were talking about this pipeline going through Kandahar. Now, apparently that is still on the books. You think that pipeline is a factor in all this?
No, I don't think that the pipeline has played a role in terms of decision-making about U.S. military presence. I mean, I think, again, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, of course, it was triggered by 9/11. And I've done a good deal of research on this, so this is something that I speak about with pretty strong conviction. The neocons, people in the Pentagon, particularly Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, as well as Dick Cheney, were determined to avoid going into Afghanistan. They were very concerned about not having a military engagement in Afghanistan that could possibly stand in the way of their real objective, which, of course, was to invade Iraq. And so not only before 9/11, I mean, they were poo-pooing the CIA's warning about an al-Qaeda attack against American interests, but even after 9/11 attacks took place, they were continuing to try to sort of downgrade the threat from al-Qaeda, and particularly to downgrade the idea that the United States should go after bin Laden and his lieutenants in Afghanistan. And what happened in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks was that George Bush felt that he had very little choice but to do something to show the American people that he was responding to the 9/11 attacks. He gave them the idea that he was going after bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but in fact, there was never any serious effort, there was never any plan to capture or kill bin Laden or any of the other al-Qaeda leaders. They really, even then, did not care, did not regard al-Qaeda as a primary U.S. interest. And I would argue again that what happened was that once the American and NATO troops were there in Afghanistan, they had to have a mission, and so it became the mission to strengthen a government and keep it in place, and that has, of course, caused all the mission creep that we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years.
Well, we have.
And again, it invokes the institutional interest of the U.S. military in making sure that they come out of this with a positive rating from the American public, that they know how to fight a war and that they did a good job. They do not want to be tagged with a loss in Afghanistan.
Let's see. We have another caller on the line. Gareth Port, are you? We were told that you could stay with us for half an hour. Do you have time for one more call?
One more question, right.
Okay. We have, I think, Joanne on the line.
Yeah, I'm glad I can hear this program, because when I go to public meetings, even with all the audio, I can't hear the speakers. But anyway, you know, I'm tired, and that's not the right word for me, for my circumstances. Year after year, I hear these talks, these analyzing, all this information, year after year. We need physical action. I do not have any intellectual ideas or plans about it, but I think I should at least get credit for having the awareness. Again, thanks for the program.
Civil disobedience.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that. I mean, not happy, but I'm satisfied that this caller really wants to do something about the problem. I think that's very important, that we have people that don't want to just listen and think, but who want to take action. And apart from, I mean, you know, I support protests of all kinds against the war, but beyond that, I think there has to be more than protests. There has to be organizing around a strategy to basically dismantle the permanent war state, mm-hmm. to take away its funding, to take away its legal power, to constrain its legal power through legislation. Now, I mean, that's... And I'm presenting an objective which requires enormous amounts of work, and I apologize for that, but I don't know how else to say it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for being with us. We've been talking with Gareth Porter, investigative historian and reporter. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Yes.
Thank you very
much. It was good to be with you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Now we'll continue. Me and Zahir Wahab, who just got back from Afghanistan. What was it like there?
Well, I have been going to Afghanistan for the last 10 years.
Right.
And I think this was my 14th trip since early 2002. And I just got back this last Friday. And I can tell you that the situation continues to deteriorate.
Now, where were you, actually?
I was in Kabul, and it's very difficult to travel. I can tell you that anyone who is associated with the Afghan government from top to bottom, or anyone who looks foreign and Western, is a target. Foreign-looking people, especially, could not walk even in Kabul in a broad daylight for about 100 yards without massive bodyguards and security. So there's much more violence. For example, in the first week of June, there were an estimated 700 encounters between the insurgents and the occupying forces. So whether you're looking at the insecurity, violence, encounters, death and destruction on both sides, the wrecking of the country, the civilian casualties, poverty, sickness, etc. Everything seems to deteriorate and get worse, except for a very small class of war profiteers who are both Afghans and expatriates. And, I mean, you see some of the most grotesque display of wealth that you have ever seen in a fifth world country.
I've heard about that. I mean, like these compounds where with these NGOs kind of and these aid people, they all live very well indeed.
You can rent a house for say $15,000 to $20,000 in Kabul. Real estate has skyrocketed because there's so much money, and it's all stolen money, whether it's narcotics or stealing from the foreign aid funds or in other ways, smuggling of drugs, weapons, people, etc. So it does not look very good at all. It's very, very distressing. In fact, it's very painful to see how we are tearing this society apart. And the Americans and NATO continue to pit Afghans against each other, village against village, ethnic group against ethnic group, religious group against ethnic group, in order to advance its own agenda. NATO and the Americans are working with some of the most criminal elements in Afghan society, top to bottom, and they're protecting them simply because they're useful for the occupying forces.
Wow, this is the KBOO's Friday call-in show. A number to call is 503-231-8187. I am here with Professor Zahir Wahab, and we talk about Afghanistan and Obama's recent speech. About the narcotics, I've always wondered. I mean, we know all about the opium production. Now, where does that money go?
Well, the money goes...
got to be laundered somewhere.
A lot of it goes to Dubai. You probably have read about this major Kabul bank collapse, which was the largest private bank. And $1 billion were disappeared from this bank, and that meant the bank officials, who are all connected, of course, and government, high government members, including members of the parliament, some wealthy people, etc. They just took the money, borrowed without any documentation or anything, and invested it in Dubai and other places. The drugs money is all over the world, maybe even in Portland.
Well,
and it's invested, and a lot of it is invested inside the country in essentially real estate, in some small private sector enterprises. But it just disappears because there's no record of it.
Because I've heard, about a year or two ago, there was a UN guy in charge of global crime was saying that a lot of this money winds up on Wall Street. It's what keeps our stock market afloat.
There is that school of thought. There are people who would assert that maybe, and there was actually an investigation, some German soldiers were involved in narcotics trafficking. But the more tragic part that is not talked about, there are a few individuals, the Afghan mafia, the drug mafia, and the international mafia, the Russian, Central Asian, and even apparently Latin mafia are involved in the drug business. But the The other part of it is that millions of people depend on now drugs, but also there are an estimated 2 million addicts in the country. In a country where really there's very little ability to treat these poor people, and you see them lying on the streets and under bridges in Kabul. That's the part that is not talked about, addiction, massive addiction, and what that means for the country's economy and culture and family lives. That's the tragic part of it.
So a lot of this money goes to Dubai, and then it sort of kind of disappears, goes scattered underground,
and
then a lot of it winds up on Wall Street and who knows where else.
Yes, well, Dubai, you know, no questions asked, and you'll be amazed how full the planes are between Kabul and Dubai in both directions. People spend, there are Afghans who spend their weekends in Dubai.
Really?
You know, yes.
So they take off from Kabul and
yes. And they carry cash. You know, Dubai will not ask any question. People have been caught with suitfuls, you know, full of cash, suitcases full of cash, and no questions asked.
Boy, little kind of echo of Iraq. Was that like $13 billion was loaded on? It was on pallets, shrink wrapped on pallets.
That's right.
Just kind of wound up.
Well,
no,
you can say the same thing about Afghanistan. I mean, apparently the United States and allies have spent perhaps $20 billion in the last 10 years on so-called development. But there's very little sign of it. For most Afghans, life has only gotten worse. For a few Afghans, this is the best of times. So whether you're looking at literacy, whether you're looking at, you know, the UN just came out with a report saying Afghanistan ranks, you know, in terms of the Human Development Index toward the very, very bottom. Literacy, healthcare, food, diet, drinking water, sanitation, and so forth. By the same token, you know, a UN report just came out about a week ago, which ranked Afghanistan as the worst and the most dangerous place in the world for women and children.
You know, a couple months ago, Malalai Joya was here.
Yes.
Is she back in Afghanistan now? Do you know?
I don't really know where she is. She has to be, you know, very, very careful because she would be a target. But for those who are interested in the conditions of women and Washington justifying this occupation and invasion to, quote, liberate Afghan women, I think they should read Malala Joya and also read the RAWA, R-A-W-A, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, or MADRE reports to see what has been done to women.
Boy, you know, I just heard on, I think it was on the World Show the other day, you know, they were interviewing some woman in Afghanistan. Actually, two. One was an American woman, one was Afghani, and talking about, you know, they were concerned about, you know, women's rights if the U.S. had to leave. And I just wished I could call in and say, why don't you talk to Malalai Joya? Because she's put her life on the line, and here she is. She is calling for the troops to leave.
Or any of my students, any woman, Afghan woman, because as I said, this is true that in the cities, you know, a few women, I would say, for one thing, 85% to 90% of the Afghan women are still illiterate at this point. And their enrollment in universities, high schools, and schools is very, very low in comparison to men and boys. But women still, now, the joke in Afghanistan is that during the Taliban, we were safe but not free. Now we're free, but we're unsafe. Violence against women now of all kinds, you know, abductions, trafficking, rape, domestic violence, etc., are, as I said, the UN itself issued a report. If people think that the Pentagon, you know, people like Rumsfeld and Bush and so forth are, you know, feminists, they should really think about that. But also what the women need, I mean, women's lives have been made more difficult because of these night raids, you know, because you have these special operation forces who come in the middle of the night and take or kill your men, children, and so forth. Afghanistan has the largest percentage of widows in of any country, you know, and the largest number of orphans, which means that women have been, you know, more encumbered by this occupation because they have been impoverished, they've been widowed, you know, they They suffer. They're not free. It's a very difficult situation.
Wow, especially for widows. But we do have another caller on the line, I think. John is on the line. Hey, you're on the air, John.
Hi, folks. Hey, thanks for fighting for truth and justice. I'm a proud member of KBOO Community Radio. And my question is, I was part of that corrupt mess in Vietnam, unfortunately. And at least they had military script over there that was supposedly being used instead of greenback dollars. And, of course, there was a huge black market. And I was wondering if you folks know if they're using anything like that in Afghanistan, Iraq, to hopefully hold down some of the corruption. And I'll take my answer off the air, and thanks a lot for your good program. Mm,
that's an interesting question. Hadn't thought about that.
Well, corruption, everyone talks about it, you know.
That's my military script, you know. I remember when I was in the Army, they used to have this sort of military money, you know, you could spend at the PX.
Well,
but you wouldn't go.
It is now is, as I said, you know, billions of dollars have been spent to, quote, develop the country and build capacity, quote unquote. The military thing is that you have 27 what is called provincial reconstruction teams, 27 of these working in different provinces in Afghanistan. Most of them are managed by the Pentagon. Some other countries also have their own provincial reconstruction teams, like maybe, you know, Germany, Australia, et cetera. And essentially these teams are, and they were, you know, launched by Secretary Rumsfeld. These teams could be anywhere from, say, 80 to 200 or 300 people. Most of them are military, some intelligence people, and some technical experts, and a few State Department people. So that's the Provincial Reconstruction Team. And they have unlimited funds. But also the commanders, the American commanders, have billions of dollars at their disposal that they can spend in any way they want to, quote, win hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. So, and there's no accounting of that money. And that's why if you look at the congressional record, then, you know, there was just a recent report by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. There's no way to keep track of this money, you know, where the money went, on what projects it was spent on, and, you know, what happened to the money. And that's why, because essentially what the provincial reconstruction teams would do, because their basic mission really is to gather intelligence and also to, quote, win hearts and minds. And so they will do these flimsy, very, you know, silly projects just to make, to find some kind of employment for the local people, you know, dig a well or build a little bridge or maybe even paint the mosque. But the idea really is to sort of befriend the people and also to gather intelligence on the insurgents.
And pass out the money.
And to pass the money. And as I said, there's no accounting of this money. And that's why there's no money, but also there's very little development in the countryside. So you can sort of conclude, you know, where the money may be going. But there have been every now and then exposés in the press where especially the contractors, and this includes American contractors, they're making a killing, literally. You know, say, charging the U.S. taxpayers and the U.S. government, say, $1.5 to $2 million to pave a mile of a road. There are stories like that.
Wow.
Or building clinics and schools that collapse in 6 or 7 months, or that are just sitting there because no one would dare. So money is disappearing.
Boy, well, you know, you hear, I know the radio news, you know, like an NPR, they'll have a lot of stories, you know, supposedly from the soldiers who are right there telling about the wonderful stuff they're doing.
Well,
is that, I mean,
well, yeah, they're doing stuff. But again, as I said, it's insincere and it's, you know, the motives are, again, everything in Afghanistan is sort of militarized and politicized, from dispensing medicine to building schools to digging wells to whatever the objective really is, to again win hearts and minds, and to gather intelligence and to, you know, get rid of the bad guys. The people know that, and that's why they don't really want to associate with these projects. Because they're afraid, and they know that, you know, that the motive is something else instead of developing Afghanistan. You know, there's no employment, there's no productivity. You know, any Afghan, especially men, is trying to leave the country. I mean, we have a massive brain drain from the country because there's no hope, there's no future. We have been there for 10 years, and we still haven't provided, say, safe water or electricity in the, even in the cities, or say half of the school-age children are not in schools, and the school, the children that who go to school, half of them have no buildings. I have university, which is maybe 5 miles from the American embassy, where there are classrooms without instructors in Kabul itself. So you can wonder, you know, what happens to the money and how this development project is going.
Well, you heard President Obama's speech. What do you think's gonna? You told me you think it really falls short. What do you think's gonna happen next? Do you have any idea?
The speech itself, which is Obama's speech, I would say, I thought it was vague. I thought it was disingenuous. I thought it was disappointing, and I thought it was plain deceptive, because as he was talking, and it's amazing, you know, that. He spoke for 13 minutes about a war which was, you know, questionable, immoral to begin with, you know, a war in which 1,600 Americans have been killed, 12,000 wounded, some 40,000 Afghans killed, $500 billion. And he talks about this for 13 minutes, you know. But also, as he was speaking about troop withdrawal, his team is trying to impose this long-term you know, base agreement on the Karzai government, which Porter to refer to. The Afghans in Karzai really don't want that, and Afghanistan's neighbors don't want an American base. I mean, if you were a country, would you want an American, permanent American base next to you? And it's interesting, you know, because they're expanding the airports in Shindand, in Bagram, in Kandahar, in Mazar-e-Sharif, in the northern part. So while he was talking about, quote, gradual peace in winning all of this, you know, the U.S. is not winning this war. And I don't think the Americans are going to leave. I think there's going to be a permanent presence like maybe Korea or Okinawa or something like that. Because there is a, and I, this is where I disagree slightly with Gary Porter. I think there's a larger agenda, and that has to do with U.S. hegemony in that part of the world for economic, ideological, and geopolitical reasons.
And then there'll be a lot of resistance.
Well, but I didn't think he was very straightforward. But I don't blame Obama, because he's just a symbolic president. The real power is in somebody else's hand.
Well, we have another caller on the line. Before we get to the caller, let me tell you what's coming up on KABU at 9, One Land, Many Voices. The hosts, Wael and Will, talk with Palestinian Economy Minister Mohammed Shtaya about the plans for declaring an independent Palestinian state. And then they will speak with Electronic Intifada founder Ali Abu Nima. At 10, you hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoint says more on Obama's wars and what he's offering for ending the war in Afghanistan. An interview with Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center about the recent rise of right-wing extremism, and an in-depth look at a report released on the state of the ocean about the rising possibility of mass extinction. And then Michael Parenti on his new book, The Face of Imperialism. That is worth, I read the first chapter of it. It's really something. And then at 11, Carlos Chavez interviews Carlos Montes, social rights activist and co-founder of the Los Angeles Brown Berets. His house is raided by the FBI May 17th. One in a string of raids and subpoenas on activists and labor union members throughout the country. So thank you, KABU members. This is what you're getting for your support. If you're not a KABU member, you can become one by going to the webpage and clicking on the tip jar. And now we got a caller. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello. Yes, I have a question for the professor.
Mm-hmm.
I have a contact with a program called Beyond Belief. It's two women who were widowed by the attacks of 9/11 who have gone to Afghanistan to make contacts and do economic development with women widows there. It sounds to me like it's a legitimate kind of project, but I guess from what the professor has been saying about all the graft and corruption and so forth that's going on there, does he know about this project, and what is his opinion of it?
Well, thank you for the question. No, I don't really know about this particular project, but there are a lot of, there are literally hundreds of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, trying to help in Afghanistan. Some of them are legitimate, credible, clean, effective, efficient, and useful. Others are simply self-serving. There are also NGOs who, masquerade as NGOs but have other agendas, whether it's proselytizing Afghans or being part of the U.S. military. I think I would say the government-sponsored, the official help that is given in any form, whether it's the USAID or the Pentagon or the U.S. Agriculture Department or the Treasury Department or the Pentagon, these are all, even the CIA, their agenda is rather clear, and that is to sort of justify, and perpetuate and humanize the occupation and the war. And then you have private individuals, the two women that you're talking about, people like that who do small-scale things with very small budgets. I prefer these, actually, because you will be amazed. You talk about corruption. I think Americans need to be reminded that this government was not put in place by the Afghan people. This government, this system, this presidency and so forth, and the Constitution were all imposed by the United States, the UN, and the European Union on the Afghans. And we spend $10 billion a week right now to protect that government. So, and it's true that it is corrupt, it's inefficient, it's illegitimate, it has no credibility. But that's what we put there, and that's what we protect, would say, so many American lives and $10 billion a month, which is a lot of money. So I would support, private, individual, small-scale, direct help to Afghan women or children or just any Afghan. I don't really know about the particulars. But the larger project, again, is simply to make the occupation look humane.
Yes, I totally understand what you're saying. That is also my experience in Africa, that USAID is the one that has the really clear agenda that's not for the people, but some of the smaller organizations are really doing good work.
Yes,
there.
Yes. Unfortunately, the USAID now in Afghanistan, Petraeus is in charge. Even the American ambassador, Carl Eikenberry, in the new one, he has no power. The military is in charge of everything. They set the agenda, including the so-called development agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And
thank
now,
you. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. That reminds me, a few years ago, there was a woman in Kandahar. She was a former NPR reporter.
Sarah Chase.
Yes. I wonder, is she still doing this?
She's an amazing woman. Yes, uh-huh. She is incredible. She was the NPR, but they kept censoring her reports, and that's why she quit NPR.
I
would say thanks to KBOO, thanks to Democracy Now!, because if you're in Afghanistan and then you read the mainstream corporate press here, you can see how ignorant and how distorting the image, because the reporters can't get out there. Either mm-hmm. they have to be embedded with the military, or they will just send an Afghan stringer, because mm-hmm. The Western reporters can't leave their prison compounds in Kabul. So that's the information you get. So that's why we need the alternative press. So Sarah Chase quit NPR because they kept censoring her reports from the beginning of the war. And what she's doing now is she has this huge co-op, women's co-op in Kandahar, mm-hmm. which makes uses local products, you know, flowers and herbs, etc., to make fragrances,
soaps and toiletry
mm-hmm. stuff. And mm-hmm. she's amazing because she's accepted now as a feature. She dresses like an Afghan man, including a turban, mm-hmm. and she drives around in this Land Rover by herself in Kandahar mm-hmm. Because she has established herself, you know, to be there and help. And mm-hmm. apparently she gets away with it. Hmm. But then you have other women, you know, there are these two things that really need to be mentioned. One is the so-called human terrain teams. And these are American academics, PhDs in political science, anthropology, sociology, etc. They're used by the Pentagon, you know, to justify and humanize the occupation. And then you also have the so-called female engagement teams, FET. These are also American military women. And this is mm-hmm. for the feminists here. That you do have American women in the military, but also these female engagement teams who dress like Afghan women, go and drink tea with the Afghan women, because Afghan women won't talk to strange men. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to gather intelligence on the insurgency. So that's the women's contribution to the war and occupation.
I've heard about these human terrain. It's like an odd term.
Human terrain teams, yes.
Yeah, what does it mean exactly?
Just well, again, you know, the human side of the occupation and the war, you know, mm-hmm. the idea is to how to, again, make to soften the occupation and the war and the brutality and mm-hmm. and guide the American forces to sort of, you know, occupy with the least damage. And the women are simply the female engagement teams are the female version of this this operation. It's the softer, soft power, you know, mm-hmm. using soft power and using the power of the intellectuals and social sciences and all that to perpetuate and justify the occupation. It's just amazing what some people will do.
Well, I think anthropologists have long been sort of associated with, you know,
imperialism,
with the empire,
colonialism,
you know,
always,
you know,
yes.
they're sort of there. Like they are, they're almost like the recon people. They're out scouting the territory.
Yes,
you know?
In fact, if you're in Afghanistan, even in military uniform, you will see some very smart people, mm-hmm. but sort of misguided mm-hmm. ideologically. There are people with PhDs and master's degrees in uniform. But, you know, they're part of the occupying forces.
Boy. Well, I think we're going to have to end now. We've been talking with Zahir Wahab, who's just back from Afghanistan. And earlier we had Gareth Porter, investigative historian and reporter. And we've been talking about Afghanistan and the president's speech and where it's going to lead to. So thanks a lot. And tell us more about this event on the 29th. You're going to be speaking at the Unitarian Church with another person.
With Matthew Ho, mm-hmm. Again, who was military in Iraq and Afghanistan and then changed to civilian work, worked with the State Department on development project, I think, in the Uruzgan province. But what he saw in the hypocrisy and the lies and the distortions and the brutality and the misunderstanding of Afghanistan, he just quit in disgust. So well, now he works with the American Studies American Group on Afghanistan or something like that. They issue reports.
So you can find out more about that on the 29th. That's next Wednesday, 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church. Well, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Per. And thanks, Kebu.
And stay tuned, Kebu. One Land, Many Voices is coming up next.